NPR's business news starts with soaring gold prices. Maybe not a good week to buy your loved one a gold chain. Gold prices hit a new record this week, sort of. An ounce of gold reached $1,362 before slipping slightly. Now, way back in 1980, gold hit $800 an ounce, and if you adjust that price for inflation, it would work out to $2,200 today. So, strictly speaking, $1,362 isn't a record, but it's really, really high. And gold prices are up sharply this year. NPR's Wendy Kaufman tells us what's driving this surge.
The high price of gold reflects worry about inflation, the decline in the value of the dollar, and general uneasiness about the economy. Yesterday, there was some surprising and relatively good economic news, and that prompted investors to sell gold. New unemployment claims were down last week, and if that trend continues and the economy picks up, the Federal Reserve is less likely to pump additional money into the economy, a move that could increase inflation and weaken the dollar. In short, when the economy is improving, gold is less attractive as a hedge against inflation and a declining dollar. Still, consumers with old rings and gold chains to sell are reaping the benefits of the high price of gold. Brian Lurie is the co-owner of Yuppie Pawn in suburban Seattle.
A couple years ago, we'd pay in $3 and $4 a gram. Now we're paying $10, $11, $12, $13. We're paying more.
As to where the commodity price of gold is headed, some analysts predict it could top $2,000 an ounce within a few years. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Let's hear now from our movie reviewer, Kenneth Turan, about a movie featuring a horse that won the highest possible honor in the racing world, the Triple Crown.
Secretariat is a fairy tale about a horse. If you're in the mood for it, and in the mood for a strong and satisfying performance by Diane Lane, you're definitely in the right place. This is the story of the 1973 Triple Crown winner, a horse that appeared on the cover of Time and Newsweek. Lane plays Penny Chenery, Secretariat's owner. Since the horse had few problems on the track, the film has chosen to focus on the difficulties Chenery had off it. She was a woman in a man's world, a woman no one believed in.
You're guaranteeing that this horse is going to win the Triple Crown. Hasn't been done in 25 years.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
You're that stubborn.
I'm that right.
Lane is an actress with an instinct for honesty, someone incapable of false moves, and her restrained, focused performance is a stabilizing force. In an unashamed movie that can't resist pushing too hard, having someone who pulls things back toward reality is more than welcome. It's essential. As directed by Randall Wallace, Secretariat shows no fear of the sentimental, and that's putting it mildly. This is an old-fashioned, super-genteel family movie. Emotion run-amok moments are inevitable, but things rarely go too far off the rails. Keeping things exciting are those Triple Crown races that Secretariat dominated in historic style. When those pounding hoofbeats come flying down the track, it's hard not to be happy that you are there to watch them fly.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for the Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition.
Most school reform efforts are focused on teachers, but a small suburban school district in New Jersey has decided it's time to hold students more accountable. The Mount Olive schools have eliminated the D grade. Students must earn at least a C to pass a class. Nancy Solomon reports.
Last year, Mount Olive, New Jersey school superintendent Larry Reynolds began holding discussions with students and teachers about why it was that a small percentage of the district's students were doing so poorly. He found that students readily admitted they didn't do their work and didn't try their best. He found that particularly troubling at graduation time.
And then the board president and myself would hand them a diploma that we signed saying that they knew stuff that I knew they didn't know.
So, with the support of the Mount Olive School Board, principals, and teachers, Reynolds eliminated the possibility of getting a D. Students must now have an average of 70, a C.
And if you don't know 70%, it's not that we're going to give you an F and be done with it. It's that you have to learn 70%. There is not an option. The option before was just get an F and average it in. No, the option now is to do it over. So it's A, B, C, or do it over.
Mount Olive is about an hour and a half from New York City, where the suburbs meet the still rural western edge of New Jersey. The median family income is $75,000 a year, and the schools rank high in terms of average test scores. But the superintendent was not satisfied with the 389 students in the high school who got at least one D last June, even though that represents only 2% of the kids. So now, every student who gets a D or an F must repeat the class, either at a new night school, summer school, or during the next school year. The high school principal, Kevin Stansbury, says the elimination of the D sends a clear message to all students.
We feel that it's going to have a positive impact not only on our D and F students, but we feel all students, because even our B and C students somewhere along the line probably earned a C or a D or an F that brought their average down. So yes, we're focusing on one particular group, but I think it's going to have a greater effect across the board with all types of students.
Not surprisingly, honor roll students like sophomore Hannah Kim like the tougher grading, especially because it comes with extra help, even for students who only occasionally get a low grade.
When we got like bad grades, they didn't give us a chance for like retakes or anything like that. But now, like thanks to the policy, like you get 4 days to retake it or a day to make up missed homework and then peer tutoring. So I think everybody's going to be in better shape now.
Students with lower grades, for the most part, grudgingly admit it will force them to work harder. Even so, junior Ashley Scapiccio says she thinks some kids will give up and the school could have found less punitive alternatives.
I think that they could apply other tools to help students do better, maybe add an extra class that if you are getting D's, that they put you in that class and it's a smaller class and they can have teachers help you out and try to motivate you rather than just taking the D away.
Mount Olive's principal says the new policy puts more pressure on parents, too, to stay on top of their kids. Soon, the New Jersey school will begin using an automated system that sends an email to a parent the very day a student receives a D or an F score on any assignment or test. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
And every once in a while, we spend a few minutes on a dull bit of financial jargon.
Dull and, if possible, really, really obscure.
That's because this financial jargon can conceal huge, dramatic stories that affect all of us. Consider now a phrase brought to us by Alex Bloomberg and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money.
Lately, everywhere you turn in the financial media, you keep hearing people talking about this new thing, quantitative easing. Like, here are some clips from CNBC.
The discussion now at the Fed is whether there will be further quantitative easing. And so
I think
again,
the quantitative easing story is one that you're seeing across different countries.
You fundamentally believe that both in the United States and in Europe, we will go back to quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing is really one of the more impressive financial phrases out there. Impressive for the distance between how boring it sounds and how dramatic it actually is.
Because what quantitative easing actually means, at least in part, is creating massive amounts of money out of thin air. Economists, at least some economists, believe that when you want to improve the economy, you need to get more money out there circulating around.
Now, the problem is there are only a few ways to do this. One way, have the government spend money, pay people to build roads or bridges or install solar panels. That would get money into people's pockets and then out into the economy.
Only problem, we already did that one with the big stimulus last year, and it is not particularly popular. Congress will certainly not be voting in another stimulus anytime soon.
Option two, the Federal Reserve can cut interest rates, make it cheaper to borrow. People borrow more, buy more, build more new things, the economy starts working again.
The problem is we already did that too.
Now, for almost all of modern U.S. economic history, policymakers have used only these two tools, government spending or Fed interest rate cuts. That's it. But with this financial crisis, for the first time in U.S. history, those two tools won't work.
So enter quantitative easing. It's an idea the Fed is borrowing from Japan. Japan used it a decade ago when they had a similar problem.
And quantitative easing works like this. A big bank, let's say Bank of America, has $50 billion in, I don't know, government bonds. They would sell those bonds if anyone would pay enough for them, but nobody is willing to pay that much. So Bank of America just holds on to them. With quantitative easing, the Fed comes along and says, hey, Bank of America, we'll buy those bonds for a little more than anyone else is willing to pay. Bank of America says, okay, great, send us the money.
And this is where the Fed gets to use some central bank magic. They pay that $50 billion in new money. They just invent it. They don't have to borrow it or tax us for it. The Fed is the one institution in America that gets to just create new dollars.
And the idea is that now Bank of America has $50 billion extra dollars, $50 billion of these new dollars the Fed created, and they have to do something with it. The Fed is hoping that Bank of America will decide to lend that $50 billion to companies and people to invest or spend, and that this will stimulate the whole economy.
Sounds great. Create new money, get it out there, everyone wins. But, of course, there's a but.
Of course there is.
Nobody really knows if quantitative easing works. It's still really controversial among economists, and that's because it's only been tried a few times, and like in Japan, it hasn't always had the greatest results.
The Fed first used quantitative easing in 2008. It's now considering a second round.
While the economy is still bad, the Fed really might only have two options. Take this desperation step, use quantitative easing, or just do nothing. Adam Davidson.
Alex Bloomberg, NPR News.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as usual. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Your commentary this week focused on the recent suicide death of Rutgers University freshman Tyler Clementi. Now, his death came days after learning that word of an intimate same-sex encounter was made public, allegedly by his roommate and another peer. And, Michelle, you suggested that a hypersexual culture enabled by technology is partially to blame. Here's part of your commentary from this week's Can I Just Tell You?
So much of technological innovation has outstripped the moral code to regulate it, and thus too many people have become convinced that relationships are a matter of performance art. Why else do young people send underdressed pictures of themselves to each other, videotape their sexual exploits, and broadcast them on social media?
As usual, lots of people went online to respond to your commentary and also weigh in on Tyler Clementi's death. Here's a post we received from Penny. She writes, technology made this outing possible on a grand scale, but the evil that the two students enacted had nothing to do with technology. They would have found some way to bully Tyler Clementi. They are mean. They have no conscience, no empathy, no feelings, no sense of propriety. I have nothing but disgust for them, she says.
And Lee, we also received this post from Chase. He writes, my theory on why this happened was derived from my time as a young black closeted gay man in my freshman year of college. I had heard many times being gay was bad from my parents, church, private school educators, and friends. My greatest fear at that time was the discovery of my sexuality by others. I do appreciate all the people who wrote in to give us their perspective on this. And some shared some very personal stories. I do appreciate that. Lee, what else?
And now switching gears a bit, Michelle, this week we also talked about the firing of CNN anchor Rick Sanchez, and his departure was announced a day after he criticized his bosses and called late-night comedian Jon Stewart a bigot in a radio interview. Here's Rick Sanchez in the clip behind the controversy.
People who are not minorities understand that those of us who are, and very few of us will say the things that I've just said, are actually more complex than they think
Stewart's,
we are, and we get
Stewart's
them.
A minority, as much as you are.
He come on. How
He's
is he
Jewish.
A minority? Yeah. Yeah.
Rick.
Very powerless people.
Whoa.
But, I mean, but you're such a minority. I mean, you know, please.
You're telling me that...
I'm telling you that everybody who runs CNN is a lot like Stewart, and a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart, and to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority? Yeah.
His comments drew outrage in the blogosphere and led some Jewish activists to even label him as anti-Semitic. But after a roundtable discussion with media watchers who both criticized and defended Sanchez, I caught up with listener Algery, who posted this comment to our online forum.
Rick Sanchez honestly told the truth as it relates to who is running the major TV networks and media outlets. Individuals can say the most outrageous and insane bigoted things about the president, and that gets a pass, particularly by a network that begins with the letter F. Yet say anything related to the lack of diverse viewpoints, and you are completely 86. God bless the hypocrisy of America.
Well, Algeria isn't the only person to feel that way, so we received a number of posts to that effect. Lee, we also received this post from blogger Lee. I don't think she has any relation to you,
don't
but she
so.
Writes, Good riddance, Mr. Sanchez. It is textbook anti-Semitism to say that Jews are not oppressed and that they control everything. This confusion about where Jews stand in relation to power is one of the reasons anti-Semitism is so insidious. Thank you, Lee. And thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log onto our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.